Two people well known in the education sector are on the panel today. Cass Carter, an Assistant Vice Chancellor at Massey. Secondary school teacher and radio commentator Steve McCabe. Good afternoon, Cass. Good afternoon, Steve.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Now, you've both been to interesting functions. Steve, yours first. You went to the Auckland University Physics Teachers' Day.
Yes, the NCA exams are all fully underway and teaching loads are reduced, and so it's a time for teachers to go off and get together and do interesting things. This is one that's put on every year by the physics department at Auckland University. I actually like to take this opportunity to thank in particular Graham Foster at the university, Dave Thrasher, who's from Takapuna Grammar, the two gentlemen who put this event on every year. It's a fantastic opportunity for physics teachers to get together, because you have to understand, we're a very, very isolated group in our schools. You know, my science department's made up of biologists mostly, and as we all realise, biology is not even a real science. So it's nice to be in a room with real science teachers for a change. So there's 150 of us all sitting there in a room. We're listening to lectures on the discovery of the Higgs boson. It was fantastic. I mean, this was critical geek density. It was brilliant. There was an absolute seething mass of geekery going on. It was wonderful. I was with my own kind.
You didn't have to explain anything to anybody.
No.
You were all singing from the same geek book.
Oh, absolutely. It was absolutely wonderful. It was like a casting call for the Big Bang Theory. It was wonderful. Million IQ points and not a single social skill in the place. It was wonderful. It was glorious.
I can see you're buoyed by the experience.
Oh, I was among my own kind.
This is a good time of year to be a teacher, isn't it?
One of the best. And ask me again in about a week and a half time when you see a huge 7-week smile on my face.
Now, Cass, you have been running a forum on what New Zealand will look like in future.
That's right. Yeah, we've started. This is the first forum we're going to run, planning to run at least one a year, about 2050, basically because we think, Massey thinks that we're too focused on the now and the next couple of years, and we want to be thinking about long term where New Zealand should be. And for us, it's because we're teaching people who are going to be around running the country in 2050. So we held this first forum earlier this week on Monday, and our guest speaker was Daniel Franklin, who's the executive editor of The Economist magazine, and of course they do a lot on that whole future-focused area. He's just written a book called Mega Change. And he was talking about the major changes forecast for 2050, and then he sort of talked about what it meant for New Zealand. And what he actually said, which was really good, was New Zealand's actually surprisingly well-positioned for 2050. He was saying that because we're close to Asia, it's where the action's going to be in terms of economic growth, and also because we've got a relatively big agricultural sector, and one of the big issues in the future is going to be how to feed 9 billion people, that it's not that we're going to be able to feed them ourselves through what we produce, but it's more that our agri-food expertise is right up there, world class, and so we'll be able to come up with ways to increase food output. The other thing also he said is populations are getting richer around the world, and so we'll be needing to produce more variable food and more nice food, not just sort of churning out the wheat. Another point he made that was very interesting for New Zealand was that there's going to be huge population growth in Africa, massive in that area, and I think we're all sort of looking at Asia and what Asia's doing, but Africa's really growing, and we're really well positioned geographically to jump on that area as well. So, and of course we speak English, which it's still going to be the main language of the world in terms of trading. So it was quite positively focused, really.
Predictions can be notoriously, I'm sure, has a very well thought out indeed, but predictions can be notoriously unreliable if you look back on past times and what people thought the world would be like in 20, 30, 40, 50 years' time. They're often wrong.
This is true, and he said some of the predictions they've had it from The Economist, they keep popping in every year still waiting for them to happen. So, yeah, they might have got the timing wrong, but they reckon they're still going to happen. Like one of them, he actually said, was we will come upon some alien population at some point in the future, because there's so much study done on it, there must be some life out there.
If we're going to be well-positioned because of our agriculture, doesn't that imply to you that we need to do everything possible to stay clean and green, really, in terms of reputation? If we're going to be a lovely bread basket for a burgeoning population, reputation in that area would seem to matter a lot.
Indeed, and that's why we need to focus much more on ways of keeping ourselves clean and green, and it's looking at the science of it. What do we do about the rivers that our academic Mike Joy's been talking about a lot over the last few weeks? How do we improve it? And I think that's the thing, you know, the whole 100% pure New Zealand brand, it's actually a promise, you know, it's actually a promise to ourselves and the rest of the world that we have got this lovely environment, we want to keep it that way, and we should be really, really investing in our environment for the future.
You should join Tourism New Zealand, a promise to ourselves. That's got a ring to it. All right, well, that sounds like a fun forum to organise, actually. Well done. So Cass Carter and Steve McCabe are with us. First, MP Brendan Horan, who was yesterday, as we know, expelled from New Zealand First. He's been back at Parliament, sorting out a new office, taking up the role as an independent MP. Winston Peters has said, resign as an MP. Brendan Horan says, no intention of doing that. Thrown out of the party following allegations, which he denies, that he took money from his late mother, and he also denies having a gambling problem. Tony Doe's going to join us on the political implications of this. How long do you give Brendan Horan? It must be a lonely life in Parliament without a party and... with the leader cutting you off.
Winston acted so very quickly, it would suggest that there's no disputing, you know, he thinks there's no disputing the allegations, and I guess it's hugely damaging for the party, particularly given the alleged issue around an elderly victim, I suppose. I'm sort of interested in the process. I mean, this has happened before within Parliament, and I would like to think that if my boss was about to sack me, that he'd actually give me a call and tell me rather than me getting to read it on Stuff, I think his lawyer said, is where he'd read it. But I think the other thing is, the other point that's really important is that who voted Brendan Horan in, and if he is kicked out of a party that he's a List MP, then why is he still there, I think.
You were nattering to me before the panel came on about this precise matter, Steve McCabe.
I was indeed. I mean, this is the big question. Was Brendan Horan personally elected? It does, to a certain extent, call into question the entire concept of List MPs. Does it not simply mean that any time there is a party line vote, you simply add a few extra votes to that party? I mean, individual MPs, individual elected in electorates, obviously have been elected personally. List MPs, I mean, how many people who voted for New Zealand First went, oh, excellent, Brendan Horan's on the list, I'll be voting for them.
Exactly, probably none.
No, I mean, in fact, I mean, you could even say, how many people actually will go, Brendan who now? Before when they were voting. I mean, if we're being absolutely perfectly honest, how many people who vote for NZ First voted for Winston Peters? That's the bottom line. And realistically, I mean, if we go back and look, how often, for example, do List MPs not vote with their party? So basically what we're saying is List MPs are basically there to reinforce the party. Brendan Horan personally, regardless of what other panellists have said in the past, can he really claim to personally have a mandate to be in Parliament?
Okay, so the question of mandate for List MPs. Tony Doe is a political correspondent for the main report on the Trans-Tasman political newsletter. Tony Doe, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jim.
Yeah, this is an interesting wider question, isn't it? The mandate of the List MP. But first of all, are we any closer to knowing what Winston Peters knows?
I don't think we are, no. I mean, I think Winston Peters would be very reluctant to provide any of the evidence outside Parliament until things are, 100% proven. You know, there's always the question of defamation and other legal aspects to this. I mean, but presumably Winston Peters has been shown documentary evidence that he considers is strong enough to have invited Mr. Horan to leave New Zealand First.
Why was he so quick off the mark?
Well, there are people that say maybe he wasn't that quick off the mark, that perhaps that these allegations were strong enough prior to him having seen the documentary evidence for him to act. But Winston Peters likes to get things that the T's crossed and the I's dotted, and he's done that with the documents he's seen, and presumably they're enough for him. So I think that's what he was waiting for, the documents.
People who vote for New Zealand First, you know, says Steve McCabe, are essentially voting for Winston. So they want Winston to be seen to be acting forthrightly, immediately, and so on.
Well, I think so, yeah. But he looks, I suppose, good on the surface there. But there must be some judgment on accepting Brendan Horan into the party without perhaps looking into the background. And if there is, and there are only allegations at this stage that Horan is denying, but if there was a gambling problem, then that was presumably known out in the wider public. And that perhaps that's something that perhaps should have disqualified him from being put forward as an MP or a potential MP.
The precariousness of your tenure in Parliament as a lonely independent MP, before we get to the question of waka jumping, Tony, it can't be easy in there sitting there by yourself.
No, and I think that will be difficult. I mean, he's been given an office in the old building at the far end of the corridor sort of thing, and it's probably going to be ostracised to a large extent. But interestingly enough, it's not the political parties that control their MPs once they're in Parliament. It's Parliament itself. Mm. So Winston Peters can't say to Brendan Horan, look, you've got to leave Parliament. Parliament itself would have to base its decision on whether Brendan Horan left Parliament on something that he'd done in Parliament. Or there was some, say, conviction that carried 2 years jail term. So it's an interesting one. It's interesting what the panellists were saying, too, before about Brendan Horan being sort of fired on stuff or, you know, basically in the real world, that would go before an employment tribunal and that would not stand. Same as in the professional sports world where sporting heroes can be fined by their clubs and stood down and things like that. Certainly never been challenged in the employment court and probably should be. An interesting element of this particular case.
I would like to ask where this leaves electoral law at the moment, because my understanding is that the last election, New Zealand First won 8 list seats in Parliament. They now only have 7 list MPs. How does that tally?
Yeah, that's a very difficult one because MMP does allow a list MP to stay in Parliament even when they're expelled from the party. And where it leaves NZ First is actually with less resources than they were electorally, I suppose, guaranteed when they were voted in. So NZ First really is the losing body in all of this. Brendan Horan still sits there getting his salary. Winston Peters looks good on a personal level, but his party is somewhat damaged, I suppose, in its ability to operate in Parliament. Probably not damaged by the fact that Brendan Horan isn't with it anymore, because really he was not making that much of an impact, I don't think. Rated 2 out of 10 in our Trans-Tasman roll call, by the way.
Okay. Yes, right, your yearly assessment of the MPs is out now, as we know.
Exactly.
So Brendan Horan sits there getting his salary. Does he have a mandate to do that? Because this is the question of whether, you know, the list MPs have that kind of mandate. Does he or not?
Well, exactly. I mean, I would say morally he doesn't, but in terms of the way Parliament operates and within the strict interpretation of the laws as they stand, he is able to be their mandate or not. So I don't think really that if in our heart of hearts we looked at list MPs, we would say that any of them have a mandate.
Well, in that case, is it not possibly an opportunity to reconsider the way that the entire MMP system works? Well, how about this for a possibility? We simply say that Winston Peters gets his seat in Parliament, but any time he comes to cast a ballot, he gets 8 votes instead of just 1. We save 7 MPs worth of salary.
It would work really well, wouldn't it? Yeah, I think you probably got something there. And if that were to happen, that would be very interesting. And I think probably a lot of New Zealanders would agree with it.
Ian Dalziel says on the text, who are Brendan Horan's constituents now? He isn't assigned an area anymore, obviously. You know, an area of particular interest. So who are his constituents?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is a lot of sort of list MPs do make up a seat for themselves, don't they? They claim to be from a certain area, maybe the local area around their house or whatever. So they claim to be sort of list representing some part of the country. And I imagine that's what Brendan Horan will do without actually having a particular electorally guaranteed set of boundaries for which he is responsible. So yeah, it's going to be a very interesting time for him. He's really got a lot of thinking to do sitting there on the back bench.
You would think so, Tony. Tony Doe, thank you. From the Main Report, 22 minutes past 4 o'clock, Steve McCabe with Kaz Carter on the panel. The New Zealand Herald reporting that children were forced to the floor at gunpoint, while this gang of well-disguised robbers, armed with pistols and rifles and screwdrivers and hammers and knives, demanded cash from staff at a busy family restaurant. These men are thought to be responsible for 5 robberies now in Auckland's eastern suburbs over the last 2 months. Each time they've turned up in bars and restaurants full of customers, you wouldn't want to be one, would you, and demanded money while brandishing these weapons. Professor Greg Newbold will join us shortly. Did you think we were experiencing a reduction of this sort of crime? Does this sort of crime alarm you or not?
Well, this particular sort of crime very alarming. I mean, you're having a family dinner at Valentine's. You don't expect that sort of thing to happen when you're deciding what to fill your plate up on. I was interested in this because I went and actually had a look on the Stats New Zealand website. I think the thing is that crimes like this are so awful, and then they're, you know, so awful that they're in the news and we're talking about them now. But actually the figures on the website don't actually show a marked rise in violent assaults. That it showed that well, we just do have far too many, 28 serious assaults resulting in injury every day. But that's the same as it was in 1995. So that hasn't actually risen. And just interestingly enough, we have about a murder a week, or sort of 43 murders every year. And that was the same as in 1995 as well. With so, yeah, a few weeks off for holidays, but about 43 murders. So actually, if you're looking at the stats, we haven't got an increase in violent crime. In fact, there's been a bit of a decrease because there was a bit of a... an increase, which they some people claim is around the use of pee and the amount of assaults that is.
I know, and the police are always saying it's skewed perceptions. You know, crime really is going down, but you know, you tell that to the women who don't feel safe jogging at dusk, or the families who won't let their kids play in parks, or won't let their kids walk to school. You know, it's interesting, the contrast. And Greg has talked to us about that before, and will again. But before we get him on, what's your impression of how safe New Zealand is, or not?
It's what you're used to. I came to New Zealand from a country where it's not uncommon to hear of shootings and murders. I used to live in Florida in a gated community where people would have to get past big iron gates just to get into the neighbourhood. But we got used to that, and so that's what you expect. And so my wife read recently that where we live in Pukekohe, there have been burglaries, and she's getting very, very concerned about it. Always make sure that the house is locked up very securely. And I point out to her, you know, you were perfectly cool with murders in Florida. We lived in a high crime area. Said, yeah, but that was different. I expected that. It's what you're comfortable with and familiar with. And these statistics, yeah, overall, they do suggest that crime is going down. Fantastic. But as you say, tell that to the poor sod who's got a gun being held to the head over dinner. If you are the one who has experienced it, then your personal crime statistics are going through the roof.
Dr. Greg Newbold, Professor of Sociology at the University of Canterbury. Greg, good afternoon. Nice to have you on the panel. Can you remind us, please, of what is happening with crime? What types are going down, going up?
Well, property crimes are going way down. Oh, that's recorded property crimes, but frauds are going up in response, because people are, rather than going out burglarising nowadays, there's an increase in things like identity theft and credit card fraud and other types of electronic offending, which are replacing the other forms. But as far as violent crimes concerned, it peaked in the early 1990s. Murders were right up in the 70s and 80s at that point, and then have declined. Where these types of robberies are concerned, they're becoming much, much rarer. In the 1980s, there was a huge spate of bank robberies and other robberies committed by professional robbers, some of them friends of mine, who got away with lots of money regularly. The Mondes Air was robbed, for example, and robbers were able to get in and out. I'm talking about professional robbers who really knew what they were doing. They were tooled up, and they were calm, and they were well planned, and they had committed many, many, many robberies successfully, so they knew what they were doing. And they were getting away with a lot of money and living quite well, but I recently did a video for the ANZ, I think it was, or it might have been the Bank of New Zealand, on robberies, and one of these robbers, who was my mate, was on, and he said he wouldn't bother robbing anymore because there's not enough money, and the security is too great, and the chance of getting caught are too great. So, you know, these guys who are doing these robberies are absolute amateurs. I mean, they're just idiots. There's four or five of them, and they're getting away with a few $100. And they're going to get a huge sentence when they inevitably get caught quite soon. If they continue with what they're doing, they're certain to get caught very soon. They will have earned a few $100, which has to be spread amongst the four or five of them, and they are going to be doing around about 8 years each. So, I mean, they're just eggs, actually.
Can I ask you something? I mean, a woman we know was mugged in a well-to-do area of Auckland recently. I mean, in the early 1990s, the period you're talking about, and also Cass, from memory, there were few muggings per se. There was no carjacking. There were no drive-by shootings. There were no lumps of concrete tossed off motorway overpasses. We're seeing some worrying types of crime, even if crime overall is going down, aren't we, Greg?
Yeah, well, we always have seen worrying types of crime. I mean, there's been terrible murders going right back to 1948 with the rape murder of Kitty Cranston in Mount Victoria by Slim Horton. I mean, people forget, have short memories, and they forget these things, but there have always been incidents where people have been killed. In the 1950s, eight men were hanged for committing horrific murders. It was, that was a period when there was a panic about crime as well, a rising crime, which did rise dramatically in the post-war period. So, you know, these kinds of things have existed, and they've always had high publicity. And you know, there was Louisa Damodrin and Tracy Cormack, killings of little girls. You know, there's the Kylie Smith. I mean, you know, the names just roll off your tongue when you're involved with studying it, as I do. And you tend to remember the things that are most recent and forget the other. Look at the Marceau. You know, the killing of that girl just recently. Yeah. Was stabbed to death by a person on bail. So you know, these things always have happened. We remember the most recent ones.
Okay, can I ask you something?
The others just, you know, drift off into the mists of the past.
Yeah, which is a good point. I think when you were last on with us, and correct me if I'm wrong, you did describe the current situation in New Zealand, though. If there's been a decrease in violence, there's nevertheless been a rise in, I think you almost call it a hoonishness or a thuggishness, or how would you describe it?
Well, there is a rise in serious violence involving the youth gangs, what the cops call the ABC gangs, the homie gangs. There's proliferation of them, and there's quite a bit of violence involving those young guys, which didn't exist before. But then back in the 70s, we had the stormtroopers and the Black Power and the mongrel mob rioting in the streets, and that big violent confrontation up in Moira where a policeman was thrown into a burning vehicle. The profile has changed because the gangs are now mimicking the gangs of California, and the gangs of California have definitely increased in their violence. I mean, I've read a book called Monster by a guy called Cody Scott. Sanika Shakur is his other name, and he's a member. It's an excellent book, and it's worth reading.
What's it called?
It's called Monster.
Monster.
And it's a very, very real, well-written book by one of the foundation members of the Crips.
Right.
He belongs to a set called the Eight Tray Gangsters, and he talks about saying, well, we used to use shotguns and pistols, now we're using fullies, which he means fully automatics, and there's a picture of him on the cover holding an Uzi. And he admits having shot quite a few people. So, and that's what these young kids of Auckland in particular are mimicking. These are the images which they look up to, and so there has been this change.
Okay, but are you saying we're in for a version of what's described in Monster?
They haven't gone that far yet. But what you've got is these young idiots trying to be big timers in a small city like Auckland, and they will get caught. They will go to jail. They will serve big sentences. They'll get out older and wiser, and they'll probably cease offending at that point.
Yes, all right. Thank you, Greg. Professor Greg Newbold on the panel, just past the half hour now. Cascada, Steve McCabe with us, but also Hewitt Humphrey, who has the news headlines.